You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll meet a Wisconsin man who is helping to bring to life the characters in the Netflix show Ask the Storybots.
First, we're looking at President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey through a legal lens. Yesterday evening, the White House announced that they were terminating Comey's appointment, citing his handling of the investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of a private server during her time as Secretary of State.
Frank Turkheimer joins us now. He's an emeritus professor of law at UW-Madison Law School and a former U.S. Attorney General for the Western District of Wisconsin. He was also on the Watergate prosecution staff. Frank, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica. It's nice of you to have me on your program.
Well, what did you make of yesterday's decision by President Trump, seemingly sudden, to fire FBI Director James Comey?
What's your question?
What did you make of that decision to fire the FBI director yesterday?
I think it's horrendous. It was obviously, is my opinion, a phony reason, because the reasons, the facts that he gave were there on January 21st. So if that was really of concern to the president, which is surprising because the very reasons that were given to fire him were facts that the president had lauded on numerous occasions and thought highly of Comey for those very reasons. If for some reason he switches around when he becomes president, fire him on the 20th of January.
Now, we've got a tweet here from a listener named Pat who said, I'm concerned about Attorney General Sessions, who recused himself, that he's involved in firing Comey and selecting the new FBI director. What is your take on Attorney General Sessions' involvement so far and in being part of the decision to fire Comey?
Yeah, you would think that since the firing of Comey, obviously has an impact on the investigation relating concerning possible links between the Russian intervention in the election and the president's reelection campaign, that Sessions would have stayed out of it because he said he was going to recuse himself from all those matters because he had either advertently or inadvertently misled the Senate Judiciary Committee during his confirmation hearings on ties with the Russians. So I think he should have recused himself. Whenever there's a question of recusal, the smart thing to do and the right thing to do is err in the favor of recusal. I mean, if you're not sure, then what's the harm in recusing yourself? I mean, they obviously have a capable deputy attorney general, and leave the matter in that person's hands. So I think he shouldn't have been involved in the firing of Comey, and I think for the same reason, since this investigation is a very important part of what the Bureau is doing right now. I think he should have no part in the selection of a successor. But I wouldn't be surprised if it weren't going to turn out that way. And there's really nothing you can do about that. I mean, it's really up to Sessions' conscience to decide whether he should or should not be involved. And if he decides he's going to be involved, it's not going to taint the nomination or anything like that. It's just unpleasant.
So there's no law or mechanism in place that would keep an attorney general who is recused from participating?
The only mechanism is political. And, we're light years away from that happening. Theoretically, the attorney general can be impeached. But that's not going to happen. And I mention it only because I think that's the only theoretical remedy where the attorney general says, I will recuse myself from something and then doesn't. It's got to be the remedy is impeachment and removal, and that will not happen.
I want to go through some of the options in the category of what happens in this investigation next. First possible option here, maybe a select committee is formed. Could you tell us about what that would look like and how that would change things?
Well, a select committee may or may not change things. It really depends on the people who make it up. They have to have an odd number. I mean, most committees have an odd number, so if there's a vote on something, you don't have a tie. And with the Republicans having 52 Senate seats and Democrats having 46 and two independents, there's no question that the select committee, if it has, let's say, seven members, will have four Republicans and three Democrats. If the select committee turns out to be partisan, that is, if the people on it put the interests of their party first rather than getting at all the facts, then it's going to be worthless. On the other hand, if it is made up of people committed, you know, to something beyond partisanship, then it can be very effective.
And this is something that Republican Senator John McCain has been calling for in this Russian investigation. Here's a listen.
This whole issue of the relationship with the Russians and who communicated with them and under what circumstances clearly cries out for investigation.
So McCain has been outspoken about this. Does he have others on his side who are looking for that same outcome, that select committee?
Well, it does call for an investigation, but an investigation for what purpose? If the purpose is for legislation, then yes, we should have a select committee made up of either the senators or persons from the House, more likely the Senate. If the purpose is prosecution, then you either go with the existing establishment or you get an independent counsel. Obviously a legislative committee cannot charge anyone with a crime. It can only propose legislation or educate the public. A prosecutor has the power to bring a charge but can't create legislation.
Frank Turkheimer is with us right now. He's emeritus professor of law at UW-Madison School of Law, and he's giving us some perspectives here on President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey. And Frank, you mentioned a prosecutor. So this is something that has been called for from some parties, a special independent prosecutor. Could you tell us about that option and what that would entail?
Well, that would entail, in this case, I mean, I can't believe that it would be Sessions. Since the purpose of the special prosecutor would be to look into possible violations of law in terms of connections between Russian interference with our election, whether there was any cooperation with the efforts to elect President Trump, you know, obviously Sessions would not be the person making the appointment. It would have to be the deputy. And, you know, presumably, and I've not heard anything negative or bad about the deputy. He's a man who's respected by people in both parties. He would pick a person of integrity and ability who would then be in charge of that investigation and act as a federal prosecutor.
And looking at this empty slot left by FBI Director James Comey at the head of that agency, can the president, do you think, essentially handpick the next director? And how much pressure does Congress get to apply in that?
Good question. I'm wondering about that myself. Obviously, well, the head of the FBI's appointment is for 10 years. The whole idea of a 10-year appointment is to have this be a non-political appointment that transcends an administration. Comey, as you know, was appointed by President Obama. Obviously he would be around for longer than President Obama was to be around. And the nomination or the selection has to be confirmed by the Senate. So the question is, we know that it's going to take 50 votes to confirm someone. If there's a tie, the vice president breaks it in favor of the nomination, obviously. So the question is, how strident and strict will the Republican majority in the Senate be? That this be a person of recognized integrity and commitment to doing the job right. I don't have a crystal ball, and we don't know who the nominee will be, and we don't know whether there will be enough fallout among the Republican majority to ensure that only a top-level person will succeed Comey as heading the FBI.
Frank, thank you so much for making time to talk today.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure appearing on your program.
That was Frank Turkheimer, emeritus professor of law at UW-Madison Law School, joining us there to share a legal perspective on news that President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
There are many ways to bike Wisconsin. Kit Healy has her own ideas, and she enumerates an itinerary for biking the southwestern portion of the state.
1. Get on the road before the sun has truly committed to rising. Listen to the mist lifting from the ditches and the wind breathing through the holes in your helmet. Hear a towhee calling from the roadside tangle of reddening sumac and raspberry. Drink your tea drink your tea. Remember that you left your water bottle in the car. Go back. 2. Get on the road slightly later than expected. Pedal through slanted light. Let your body awaken to its primal purpose, movement. Unspool your brain. Leave it like falling yellow leaves behind you. Head northwest. 3. On the first big uphill, swerve slightly to avoid the bloated paddlefoot carcass of a dead mole. On the first big downhill, snort at least 6 gnats up your nose. Don't fight it. The brain needs protein, you know. 4. Pass a small cemetery full of German names and Norwegian names and white pines. Notice that the names are also printed on the roadsides, and the homestead markers, and the genomes of blonde teenagers who get into their first trouble out here, under the pines. 5. Ride into Mount Horeb. Go to Schubert's Diner. Sit on a swervy stool at the counter. Have a lefse burrito smothered in sausage gravy, and drink a chocolate phosphate. Regret neither. As Jerry tallies your bill with a calculator, ask him about the wooden trolls lurking around the town. If he's in a talking mood, order another chocolate phosphate, and a donut to go. 6. Leave Mount Horeb heading west. Pass a stretch of marsh bordering an almost dry cornfield. Remember that there are 2 seasons to avoid cycling in Wisconsin. Winter, and any time the red-winged blackbirds are having a bad day. When you hear their warning click and trill, pedal faster, lest you be dive-bombed and head-pecked for daring to look predatory. 7. See the horizon dipping and rising, becoming proper hills as you skirt the glacial moraine. See an eastern bluebird, a big monarch butterfly, sandhill cranes stretching their prehistoric necks southward. See a barrel-chested red-tailed hawk with something in its talons. Allow a flicker of hope in your secret animal heart that it's a baby red-winged blackbird. 8. Get yelled at by a man on a motorcycle who thinks you can hear him over his motor. Wave and smile kindly. Assume he's complimenting your shapely calves. 9. Get caught in a rainstorm you never saw coming. Heck, make it a freak mid-autumn thunderstorm. Get soaked, drenched, diluted. Watch the road become a carpet of storm-loosed leaves. Watch every pothole become a headwater of the Mississippi. Give thanks for newly replaced brakes. 10. Stop to rest. Eat a damp donut under an umbellate oak tree. Touch the craggy bark and remember the glaciers retreating 12,000 years ago. Remember millions of these trees filtering light on an endless savanna. Remember mastodon and giant birds and the first humans here, hunting, laughing, eating, fighting, falling in love, moving on. Remember the smell of wildfire. Remember it all back to life. Eons later, when you get back on your bike, headed for home, promise not to forget.
Kit Healy is a writer and outreach specialist for the Urban and Regional Food Systems Program at UW-Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now our next guest is a Wisconsin native who's realizing a lifelong dream of working in the animation industry. Nate Tice of Middleton joins us now. He's a story artist for the popular Netflix animated kids show Ask the Storybots. Nate, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, how did you get started in animation?
I just always loved it. When I was, I can remember as early as being 5, wanting to do cartoons. And I just kept following that, and Mr. Elin, my high school art teacher, recommended Savannah College of Art and Design, and I just kind of continued from there.
So for those of us who might have this old-fashioned notion that animation happens on a piece of paper with a sketch pencil, it's probably all on computers now, largely, isn't it?
It is. I learned on paper, so we didn't have the touch screens and whatnot that we have now. So all through college and everything I learned on paper. But now, we use, I use a Cintiq monitor, it's called, and everything is drawn right on the monitor with a stylus, and the paper is completely gone. It's way more efficient.
How different is it? Is it a different experience drawing by hand versus drawing on the Cintiq monitor you were talking about?
Yeah, it took some getting used to at first. You didn't have the same tactile response that you do with, like, pencil on paper.
So let's talk about how you got involved with the production studio Jib Jab. They're the ones who launched this show that you're part of, Ask the Storybots. How did you start working with them?
Sure. I created a personal website in about 2009, and it got posted on a site called CartoonBrew.com, which is a big animation in the animation world. That's a site we all kind of go to. And Evan, who's one of the founders of Jib Jab, saw it and called me up. And we just went from there. I started working with them in 2009. I started with eCards. And since then, I've just been kind of on and off with them. So.
And Netflix has called this program now, that which is, I think there's one season up. It's called Ask the Storybots. It's called it very bingeable. What's the premise of Ask the Storybots?
Yeah, it follows the characters of Storybots. There's a group of characters that every episode a kid asks a question, like, how do airplanes fly? Why is the sky blue? How does rain happen? And then they go about, kind of in a roundabout way, figuring that out for them and kind of answering in a way that the kid could understand, like really breaking that down and why answering those questions.
And you do some of the voicing for the actual bots, right?
Yeah, I'm not a voice actor by any means, but I do some laughing. So there's two characters that just kind of always laugh.
And they would giggle
about everything.
This is Hub and Bub?
Yeah, Hub and Bub. And I kind of just fell into that where I do all the voices, like when I create an animatic, which is like a moving storyboard, and kind of plan out the episode. And you do all this, like, you just do all the voices, but you expect that they're going to get replaced with professional. But they just liked how I did those characters, so they asked me to do the final voices.
So I read that you said you're kind of a shy guy. Is this a good profession for someone who doesn't exactly want to be on the spotlight but wants his creation to be part of the world?
Absolutely. You sit, like for me, I sit in kind of like a dark room all day long, like by myself, just drawing pictures and like laughing to myself or whatever at what I'm drawing or coming up with. And it's perfect for shy people.
And I heard that on the show that there are also celebrity guest appearances. I was watching the trailer. I'm pretty sure I saw Jay Leno and at least Al Yankovic.
Yep. We've had the director Kevin Smith on, but I haven't been able to meet anyone yet, but hopefully at some point I will.
Well, it sounds like a cool job to have. What is an average day like for you?
I'm freelance, so I work from home. So I get up, I go downstairs, and I just start like drawing and working on the episode. And it's a lot of work. I'm usually always working, and I come up for dinner or whatever, and I work late into the night, and then get up the next day. So.
It's a lot of working, but at least the commute is good.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not very exciting.
Not pretty. So much to see on the stairs.
Yeah.
So do you have advice for people who want to get into your line of work, maybe young people coming up who need a little extra nurturing, finding that career path toward animation?
Sure. A couple things I would say is watch, like take in everything. I was given that advice when I was in high school, like watch as many movies as you can, like all kinds of movies. And it really helped me kind of like develop what I like, what I didn't like, and expose me to new ideas and new films and new ways of telling stories. And then I would also suggest, which is something I still struggle with all the time, is just get, like, the ideas done. Like, sometimes you can get kind of hung up in, this isn't good enough, I'm not doing well enough, and all that, and just really focus on just trying to get it done out there. Otherwise, you end up with a bunch of ideas that just kind of sit in your computer and never get finished.
Is there a particular animated movie that you just love that you go back to for inspiration?
There's a bunch. I think I was like 12 when it came out, so I was like the perfect age. Is Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Mm.
Was kind of the one that, you know, now I have some different tastes and stuff, but that was the one that really like struck a chord with me when I was a kid.
And that was pretty revolutionary back then.
Yeah, yeah. And I had already liked, like, Looney Tunes and all that, and it was, you know, pulling from a lot of those cartoons. So it just really, like, worked for me, I guess.
So what is next for Ask the Storybots? Do you think there's going to be another season?
We're working on a ton of stuff right now, and I can't talk much about it, but there's a lot more coming, so lots of different content.
Okay, well, keep an eye out. Nate, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Nate Tice is a story artist for the Emmy-winning animated TV show Ask the Storybots on Netflix.
Now, since President Trump won the election and Republicans retained control of Congress, there have been arguments that we would see a rise of the left in response. Some people have even theorized that part of the reaction to the conservative majority in office would come from the religious left.
Reverend William J. Barber has become one of the key figures in the religious progressive movement. He led Moral Mondays, a series of vigils that were held outside North Carolina's Capitol and got attention. Attendees opposed restrictions on abortion, limits on voting, and efforts to repeal the state's Racial Justice Act.
That's the Racial Justice Act. But despite the attention that the religious left has gotten since the November election, our next guest says it probably won't match the political clout of religious conservatives. Daniel Cox is the director of research at the Public Religion Research Institute. He joins us now. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've seen articles, commentators out there saying, yeah, we're going to see the religious left really come into prominence under a Donald Trump presidency. Why do you see that as unlikely?
Well, there are a number of reasons I identified when I wrote this piece for 538. And one of the bigger factors is wholly demographic. We're seeing a sea change in religious identity, and we're seeing that self-identified liberals are disaffiliating from religion at rates much higher than moderates and conservatives. So there are simply fewer religious liberals out there.
And let's talk about a religious left compared to what? What do you see as the power of the religious right? How did it come together? How much clout has it had?
Well, the religious right has been around, at least, you know, most people place it around the late 70s, early 80s, and it's had a phenomenal impact in reshaping the cultural and political debate. But when you look at some of, you know, the policy changes, they haven't got a lot of what they've been advocating for over the years. But in terms of the way we talk about issues and the issues that we're talking about, whether it's sexual morality, same-sex marriage, abortion, they've had a big role in raising the profile of those issues.
And you write in that piece you mentioned on 538 that the religious right finds a constituency that finds it easier to come together on issues. The religious left, the people they'd have to bring together, there's not necessarily that kind of consensus. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so one of the things I did in the piece is I looked at potential members of the religious left, so Muslims, Black Protestants, Hispanic Catholics, white mainland Protestants, Jews, and Buddhists, and looked at them just over three different issues, the legality of abortion, same-sex marriage, and views of immigrants. And basically what you see on just these three issues that these groups are all over the board, and there's not a consensus across any one of these three. So, for instance, Muslims are less likely to say gay couples should be allowed to marry, but they're very supportive of legal immigration and supportive of immigrants, black Protestants, much more reticent on the issue of same-sex marriage, but favor access to abortion and are more ambivalent about immigrants. So, there's no consensus across even these three issues, and I didn't even get into economic issues in the article.
Let's look back a bit. Have we seen a moment in American history where the religious left was more prominent?
Absolutely. I mean, if you think of the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement following Vietnam, a lot of these movements were infused with religious energy. The civil rights movement in particular, you could say sort of started or at least was incubated in the black church, but also found support among white mainline denominations and among Jewish leaders as well.
We're talking to Dan Cox from the Public Religion Research Institute, looking at the rise of the religious left and why he thinks that won't actually happen. We won't see a cohesive religious left movement in this country, not with a lot of clout and unity anyway. Reverend William J. Barber, we mentioned, architect of the Moral Monday movement. Here's a clip of him speaking at the Democratic National Convention.
When we fight for 15 and a union, and universal health care, and public education, and immigrant rights, and LGBTQ rights, we are reviving the heart of our democracy.
Got a lot of attention for Reverend Barber's efforts in North Carolina. Why did people on the left get so excited about that, see so much potential there?
Well, I think you have to look at the context. North Carolina went through a sea change politically where they moved sharply to the right. And I think, what happened there was a bubbling up of progressive energy to oppose a lot of the changes that a conservative legislature and governor were trying to impose. And I think that was the biggest thing animating progressive folks in the state.
But you don't see that translating into a wider nationwide effective movement.
I don't. And the other thing that we haven't talked about is the fact that on the left, too, there's not as much clamoring for religious rhetoric in the political sphere. In fact, if you there have been studies that have shown that when secular liberals hear religious rhetoric, they actually get turned off and are less likely to engage. So, that presents a significant problem when you want to try to create a coalition that spans the secular religious divide.
Yeah, you write about in your piece, the success of the religious right kind of put conservative as being attached to the brand of religion in a lot of ways. People saw religion and thought conservative politically, so that's a turnoff for people you see on the left.
Yeah, and this is particularly true for young people, right? So remember that, young people, the civil rights is history. It's a movement that happened in the past. And for them, when they think of religious activism, it's sort of wholly owned by the right. And so they think of opposition to same-sex marriage, opposition to abortion, sort of sexual morality issues generally. Because they don't have the sort of historical reference points that older Americans have.
You also write about social media being a big rallying point for successful left protest movements, resistance movements, especially since Donald Trump's election, and the religious left not really being on social media that much at all.
Yeah, there's a pretty significant gap there when you look at some of the leaders on the religious right and those on the religious left in terms of their activity on Twitter or Facebook. And this is not to say they're not doing anything, but there's just a pretty significant discrepancy. And I speculate that at least it has something to do with age, that your average religious liberal is, I think, pushing 50.
We're talking to Dan Cox, Director of Research at the Public Religion Research Institute. We're looking at why he believes the rise of progressive religious communities in response to the election is unlikely.
And we want to hear from you. You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you see a rise of the religious left? Wherever you are on the political spectrum, is your faith an important part of your politics? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Dan Cox, Director of Research at the Public Religion Research Institute. We're talking about the religious left in the United States. He says it probably won't become a movement on a par with the religious right.
And you can tell us what you think by calling 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you think that we're seeing or are about to see the rise of progressive religious groups after the election? If you're a member of the left, tell us if you consider yourself religious. Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now. Dan is with us in La Crosse. Dan, hi.
Hi. I just tuned in. Maybe you've already covered this, but I get a lot of emails from Theos, P as in Peter, A-T-H-E-O-S, and Sojourners. I would consider both of them Christian left organizations. I've been a Republican, a Democrat. Right now I'm an independent and a strong Christian.
Dan, thanks for the call. And Dan Cox, you don't say there is no religious left out there, just that you're not seeing it rising as a really prominent political force.
Yeah, it's sort of fractured. So there, and particularly at the elite level, you can see signs of it in these particular institutions like Sojourners and Interfaith Alliance and those. But when you look at the grassroots, there just doesn't seem to be the same type of activity and organization.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We go next to Pat on the line in Three Lakes. Pat, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Well, my opinion is that religion is just about like any other part of our situation in the United States of America. Money talks. The religious right controls tremendous amounts of money. The Bradleys in Milwaukee, the Koch brothers, it's amazing. Liberty University, the religious left, if there is such a thing, controls nothing. The religious left is more or less about protesting. I don't have a stake in either one of them, but the religious left is never going to go anyplace because they don't have any money to go anyplace.
Pat,
good
ideas. I gotcha, Pat. Dan, he's saying the religious right more prominent because more money.
Well, the caller raises a good point, and I think some folks in the religious left would raise that complaint, you know, particularly with the Democratic Party. When you look at the major campaigns, Hillary Clinton's campaign, even Barack Obama's campaign, there was not a huge investment in religious outreach. So I think that, you know, goes to the sense that, you know, this is not a constituency that has the ears of leadership in some cases.
Pat, thanks a lot for that call. I wanted to ask you, Dan, about maybe not an overarching religious left, but single issue coordination involving people of faith. I'm thinking of, you know, maybe the sanctuary movement, immigration movement, where there might be Catholics joining with people on the left over that issue, where they might be on opposite sides of the fence, say, on an issue like abortion.
So one of the things that's really challenging for progressives is there's, you know, if you look at sort of these silo issue groups like the environmental movement, they have a problem with sort of bringing in people of different racial, ethnic, religious backgrounds. And so one of the things that I think the religious left could conceivably offer the wider progressive movement is a way to sort of bridge some of these racial and ethnic differences in a way that I think could prove quite effective in the long term if they could get their act together.
Right. I've seen arguments that the left has a hard time making moral arguments for causes they favor because they've ceded the religious ground, the religious part of morality, to the right. Is there something to that?
Well, I do think there's greater hesitancy among liberals in general, but religious liberals as well, in mixing religion and politics. So you find when we ask questions about church-state separation, that liberals and religious liberals are much more likely to agree than conservatives. And I think at least some of this goes back to the fact that the main form of religious activism, as we talked about over the last 20 years, at least the one that's been most salient, has been conservative activism.
Talking to Daniel Cox, director of research at the Public Religion Research Institute, a recent piece he wrote about the rise of the religious left and why that rise isn't happening and is not likely to happen. I mean, a lot of people writing in favor of this argument, Dan, see this, what they're hoping for in most cases is a rise of the religious left as a reaction to a strong performance in the elections from Republicans, winning the presidency, keeping their majority in both houses of Congress. Do you see that potential for a backlash to kind of fuel growth in the religious left?
Yeah, I think insofar as, you know, Trump does things that are very controversial, his approval ratings remain mired in historically negative territory, that's going to bolster the progressive movement largely and the religious progressives as well.
Would you see it making sense for Democrats as a party or for individual candidates to put more energy into courting religious groups, religious voters in general?
Yeah, one of the interesting things that I mentioned in the piece is that increasingly people who are religiously unaffiliated have been an increasingly important part of the Democratic base because this group has grown dramatically over the last couple of decades. 25% of Americans are now religiously unaffiliated. However, this group does not turn out at nearly the levels of religious Americans, and it's really difficult to reach them. So how do you go, where do you go? How do you reach someone who's unaffiliated? They don't regularly go to a congregation, whereas it's much easier to activate people who are attached to religious communities. And so I think that it makes a lot of sense to you know, reach out, particularly in communities of color, who tend to be more religious in general. Because while unaffiliated folks could be potentially a huge untapped pool of voters, it's not clear to me at this point how religious liberals can reach them.
Oh, we heard from Nick in Milwaukee, called but couldn't stay on the line. Nick says he's part of the religious left, but he doesn't feel he has a voice. He teams up with progressives, and many of them, he says, are atheists, don't like that he has a religious background. Do you see that tension on the left? Obviously, there's been strong back and forth between the so-called new atheists lately and people of faith. Is that a part of the obstacle here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you look at the views of atheists in general, people who are non-believers or don't believe in God, they don't generally have as anti-religious ideas and views as some of the new atheist crowd, Richard Dawkins and those folks. They tend to be concerned about religion and politics mixing, but don't have the sort of visceral negativity that some of that crew does.
And I wanted to ask, you've written about a religious diversity in the United States and a huge growth in that religious diversity. How has that shaped our politics?
Well, one of the interesting pieces that I wrote also at 538 was how we're becoming a more religiously diverse country and how that will affect our religiosity. And that piece explores the way that religious diversity actually may be undermining our religious commitment in the country.
We'll leave it there for now, Dan. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
We've been talking to Daniel Cox, director of research at the Public Religion Research Institute. He joined us to tell us why he believes the rise of a religious left after President Trump's victory is unlikely. You can read more. You can check out his piece and some of the data he's working with. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. And you can, of course, share your thoughts while you're there.
Wisconsin's once thriving industrial hemp industry could be poised for a comeback. Three bills in the legislature would allow farmers and some researchers to get licensed to grow the crop that is often mistaken for marijuana. However, a Wisconsin tribe says it's being left out. Patty Murray reports.
Wisconsin was once the country's top hemp producer.
During World War II, this area was the mecca of hemp production in the entire country.
Rob Richard directs government relations for the Wisconsin Farm Bureau.
Some will say that there's just an insatiable desire for hemp products in the United States, whether it's the fiber or the oil.
Hemp thrived in Wisconsin in the early to mid-20th century. It was encouraged during the war to make rope. During peacetime, it became cheaper to import hemp and the industry died. Now, Richard says hemp can be used to make battery components and building materials. A provision in the 2014 Farm Bill allows for industrial hemp production as long as states give the go-ahead. Wisconsin is one of 19 states that haven't done so. Industrial hemp has less than 0.3% THC content, the intoxicating element in marijuana. By comparison, lab tests of legal recreational marijuana in Colorado have found THC content as high as 30%. Richard says hemp isn't a magical crop that's going to save farming, but says it can be lucrative.
Hemp farmers up in Canada, some of them are getting $500 to $600 per acre of net income off of hemp, whereas, you know, if you look at corn and soybean prices, our farmers are probably going to take a loss.
There are two similar assembly bills with one big difference. Both require farmers to get a license and provide GPS coordinates of their fields. Both would also allow institutions of higher education to grow research crops. However, one bill doesn't include the state's tribal colleges in that research. Republican Representative Jesse Kramer of Kewaskum has introduced that bill.
Right now, we're importing $500 million of industrial hemp a year into this country to use in high-tech products. But we're not growing it here and doing it ourselves. We're bringing it in from Canada and other nations, which is absurd. I mean, we should start growing this stuff right here in our backyard.
In 2015, a small hemp plot on Menominee land was raided and destroyed by the DEA. Gary Besaw is chair of the tribe. He says his tribe doesn't have an official stance on any of the bills, but adds tribal schools should be treated as other institutions.
We would ask that we be treated no different than anybody else, and that any allowances or economic opportunities in that way, we would be treated the same as anyone else.
Kramer contends his bill doesn't cut tribes out. It doesn't give research consideration to tribal colleges, such as the one on the Menominee Reservation in Kachina. Instead, he says tribes would apply for licenses through the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection, like any other farmer.
So rather than certifying through their colleges or their own tribal leadership, they also have to go to the state just like anyone else does.
Marcus Greeno is a Menominee member and is active with Hempstead, a pro-hemp nonprofit group. He doesn't speak for the Menominee, but believes the tribal colleges should have the same standing as any other college or university.
It hinders us, you know, in a way, because, you know, the whole idea of the indigenous way of thought or the indigenous way of thinking or the indigenous way of doing research is not valid to them.
There are no hearings scheduled for any of the bills. There is bipartisan support among the three, with the main sticking point seeming to be tribal research. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.